Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, live from the first London Podcast Festival, I'm talking to journalist Hadley Freeman about what she learned from 1980s movies in her book, Life Moves Pretty Fast. Guardian writer Hadley Freeman brings us her personalised guide to American movies from the 1980s, why they are brilliant, what they mean to her, and how they influence movie making forever. Growing up in New York in the 1980s, Hadley learned everything she knows from films like Pretty in Pink, The Breakfast Club, Top Gun, The Princess Bride, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Beverly Hills Cop, and When Harry Met Sally. And we'll be talking about how the changes between movies then and movies today say so much about pop culture and society's changing expectations of women, young people, masculinity, class and art, and explains why Pretty in Pink and Ghostbusters should be put on school syllabuses immediately. So, Hadley, what were you doing then? Where were you? What was going on in the 1980s for you?
Not very much, because I was a child. So I was born in 1978 on the Upper East Side in New York, which any of you who've seen Woody Allen movies, you're basically, that's where I grew up, where all those movies were made. So I lived an incredibly sheltered, protected life with my parents. My mom worked for Sesame Street, and that was pretty much the childhood she wanted to provide for me. And the only TV I was allowed to watch was TV without adverts, which means Sesame Street in America. And videos. So I watched MGM musicals up until I was about 6 years old, and then she allowed me to start going to the video store myself. And the first movie I rented was Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and that was pretty much the end of Sesame Street for me. And I just became addicted to renting these videos because I wasn't allowed to watch TV, so I was just renting all these videos all the time. So all the John Hughes films, you know, Princess Bride, all the ones that you mentioned there, Back to the Future, and just I'm still as obsessed with them as I was back then.
Lots of those films, when seen with today's eyes, are quite, you know, the swearing, smoking, violence, sexism. Yeah. How did you get away with it?
So, well, I got away with it by sticking very safely just to John Hughes for the first few years. So that kind of eased my mother in.
But they can be quite racy as well.
Well, John Hughes, well, depends which ones. So, yeah. Like, the John Hughes teen films are incredibly conservative in a funny sort of way. There's no sex. There's very little swearing. There's very little smoking. I mean, those kids are incredibly conservative. You look at Ferris Bueller's Day Off, for example, and it's about three teenagers who skip school. And what do those teenagers do when they skip school? They go to a museum. They go to a French restaurant.
Nobody has ever done
no
in history.
And they go to a stock exchange. Like, that's what they do. So it wasn't exactly living on the edge. So I wasn't renting Risky Business, for example. And it did take me a long time to convince my mother to let me watch Dirty Dancing. And I think I had to do something like The Dishes for a week in order to be allowed to watch Dirty Dancing. So my parents were way more worried about me seeing things that were too sexy than too sweary. Or too, definitely no violence. So I didn't grow, like for a lot of people, I think 80s movies means things like what we were talking about backstage, things like Commando and stuff.
Yeah.
And that was definitely not my 80s movie experience. My 80s movies were the comedies, and my 80s movies were the teen movies. So things that were safe for a very protected 10-year-old child to watch.
In researching this, I've been thinking back on the 80s movies of my childhood, and there were things like Arnold Schwarzenegger movies.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of movies. Movies would come into my head, and I would think, oh, okay, Predator. Well,
yes.
That must be the early 90s, because you don't mention that. Oh, no, it is the
80s. It's the 80s.
Like, you know, no. Die Hard, that must be 1990, because
no.
I think you mentioned it slightly, but, oh, no, that is in the 1980s, and those were definitely my sort of touchstone 80s films.
I mean, this book is definitely, it's like my experience of 80s movies, and I have to include things like Top Gun, which is like part of my soul, and Lethal Weapon and Die Hard. But those kind of action movies I didn't get to watch until really the 90s, until I was old enough to basically cross the street on my own and could go to the video shop on my own. Before that, it was things like Princess Bride.
The other thing that I noticed, thought this immediately after we spoke about this the last time, because we've done a version of this conversation before, and there's no Spielberg in this book at all.
No,
he's a huge figure.
I know. Well, I mean, there's a bit of E.T., but the thing is, like, I actually found E.T. terrifying as a child. I mean, did anybody else find that alien completely terrifying? Especially when he's dying and he turns white, which is, like, still one of the scariest scenes in cinema to me, alongside the opening scene of the original Ghostbusters film with the librarian. That's, to me, is what counts as scary. There really isn't much Spielberg, which is weird. I mean, for me, Spielberg is more like the 70s and stuff, which is how I think of him. But, like, I try to think what Spielberg was even doing in the 80s.
Apart from E.T.,
I do think,
although the 80s is, we think of all of these sort of classic 80s movies, I think the 80s was like a fallow period.
Yeah.
So you're right, you've got, you know, Jaws and Classic Cars in the 70s.
Yes, that's right. Or Indiana Jones.
Yeah, and
so
Indiana
there's
Jones
a lot of Indiana Jones. But you're right, it's not his era. The 80s is not his era. The 80s is really the era of, basically, it's like Arnold Schwarzenegger on one side and John Hughes on the other, and that's kind of how I see it. As well as then, like, in the middle, things like Woody Allen and Nora Ephron and those people coming up. So those are the movies that I loved. Arnold Schwarzenegger I didn't get to for a while, and to be honest, I still haven't seen some of them. But When Harry Met Sally, you can ask me anything about that.
So, as this was the 80s, and you've already hinted at, this would all have been on VHS. Did
yes,
you have any sort of,
course,
cinematic experience?
Oh, well, some. I mean, I think one of the first movies I ever went to, actually, was The Princess Bride. And I remember going to see it, and I was so little. You know, the cinema seats, they fold down. I remember getting stuck like that with my legs sticking straight up like I was doing a yoga pose. But mainly it was on VHS and Betamax, even, because I am actually that old. So I still think, when I think of these movies, I think of the VHS covers. Right?
Yeah.
I still think of, like, taking them out of the sleeves and stuff. It's incredibly sentimental. I don't mean to be so nostalgic about this. But so for me, it was mainly watching at home and, you know, waiting for my parents to come home from work or whatever and watching these videos.
So let's get into some of the movies you talk about. So the first one, and as I've just explained what my 80s experience was like, certainly Dirty Dancing. This is a movie that I would have ran 100 miles to have watched,
like
to have not
man.
Seen at the time.
Like every single straight man on the planet.
And have never subsequently seen.
Sure.
Until very recently when I was researching for this interview.
Yes.
This is going to be the case for a number of these films that we talk about. But I'm absolutely happy to put my hand up and say Dirty Dancing was superb.
Thank
I really loved it.
Can you spread the word among your fellow straight men? Because I feel like they all think that this is just a movie about a girl perving over Patrick Swayze's pecs. And there's definitely that element in it. But it is a genuinely good, interesting film,
It's
right?
a good film, yeah.
It's, a really
it's
good
not
film.
What I expected, no. which, well, the image that I have in my head of those films in the 80s that were like something like Footloose or something, which were very particularly marketed. And Grease, I'd sort of include in that as well. A film that I've never really liked. It's earlier. But yeah, films that are definitely aimed at not me.
Yes, sure.
Dirty Dancing is just a drama. It's not...
Well, Dirty Dancing is especially not aimed at you. It's aimed even less at you than Footloose and Grease. I mean, Grease, you've got the John Travolta character, so that's for the guys in the audience, and the way Olivia Newton-John's character is for the girls in the audience. And Footloose, I mean, the star is Kevin Bacon. I mean, it's a boy's story, Footloose. It's this guy... I mean, this just goes to show how lame 80s movies are in terms of rebellion. I mean, the whole point of that movie is he just wants to put on a prom. And, that's the rebel with a cause. But he is a boy, and it's his story, and he's trying to get the girl. So, like, Footloose is kind of for guys, but Dirty Dancing is entirely for women. And when I started researching this, i.e. watching the films again.
What great research.
My hardcore research. I mean, Glenn Greenwald has nothing on me. And so, the new Edward Snowden right here. And so I tracked down the woman who wrote the film, Eleanor Bergstein. And I called her up and I said, you know, the thing that's so funny about this film is that there's so much more in it than needs to be. It really could have just been one of those movies they make now, like Step Up, one of those kind of dance movies with kids just throwing themselves around and people wearing very few clothes. And actually, it's this whole movie. It's about the importance of abortion. It's about sort of Jewish snobbery against working class Catholic people, which is all in it. It's about this fading world of the Catskills. It's like this whole kind of crazy world in the beginning of the civil rights. You get a little bit in that movie. And it just seems to me that this is actually a pro-choice message wrapped up in this kind of bubblegum teen film. And she was really quiet, and I thought, oh my God, I've like totally freaked this poor woman out, and she's now going to like call the police and get, you know, a restraining order or something. And she went, I've been waiting 30 years for someone to say that to me. And I just thought, I knew it was on something. And what she wanted to do in the 80s, she was a feminist, married to a Harvard professor, and she felt that, she looked at young women around her, and she felt that they were taking feminism for granted, and particularly abortion, you know, access to abortion for granted. I mean, this was the 80s, the era of Reagan, you know, Nancy Reagan being Just Say No, all the rest of it. And so she wanted to make a movie that reminded young women about how lucky they are to have access to abortion. And so that's actually what the movie is about. I mean, the whole, I'm going to take it for granted that, I'm going to say 60% of you have seen this film. And
well, why don't we say,
who's
seen this film? In this room? That's probably more than 60%.
More than 60%? Okay, who hasn't? Is it the remaining men? Yes. So the plot is put into motion by Patrick Swayze's dance partner gets pregnant and has to go have an illegal abortion, and she goes like to this horrible backstreet abortionist and ends up physically in danger and nearly dies. And so she can't dance, obviously, with Patrick Swayze that night at the summer camp because they're like the dance performers there. And so Jennifer Grey steps in, and that's how their romance starts. And the whole thing continues, and you hear so much more about this woman who had this terrible illegal abortion. She was on a butcher's table. He had rusty instruments. Like, they really get graphically into it. And Jennifer Grey's father is a doctor, and he has to come and save her life. And he puts his own career in jeopardy by helping this woman, because if a doctor was found back then to have helped a woman who'd had an illegal abortion, he would get his medical license taken. So it's like a major, major part of this film that this has happened. And you keep seeing this woman throughout the film, and she's getting better and better. And then last scene, you see her, and she's like, oh, and he says I can have children again. So like, it's like she does not let you forget it. And that's what the whole film was about, and no one noticed it. The studio didn't care. It was made independently. The only people who complained about it was Noxema Cream, which is like Clearasil in America, because they wanted to advertise in it. They wanted to have product placement in it. And they saw the film right before it came out, and they were like, it's a bit like, ooh, what's all this abortion stuff? And so the producers said to Eleanor, maybe we could chop it out? And she went, oh, gee, well, we can't really, because the entire movie hinges on it, which she did deliberately. And they went, oh, right, okay, well, never mind. And they got it out. And you compare that to movies now that have abortion, and it's such a different story. Like, it's amazing. So, at first, I started to think about this years ago when I wrote about abortion in movies today for The Guardian. And it was when Juno came out, and also Knocked Up came out, I think a few months later. And this other movie came out, Waitress. And in each of those three movies, a female character gets pregnant unexpectedly. And whenever anyone suggests that she have an abortion, like, it's horrible. Like, those people who suggest abortions are horrible. And Juno in particular, where this 15-year-old girl gets pregnant. I'm sure most of you have seen Juno at this point. 15-year-old girl played by Ellen Page gets pregnant. She decides to have an abortion. She walks to the clinic. She sees a classmate there, you know, protesting, going, "This is terrible. You're killing your baby. Your baby has fingernails." And she goes, "Oh, my baby has fingernails." And she goes into the clinic, and it's this disgusting place. It's, like, you know, dirty. There's, like, the receptionist kind of giving a blowjob to a lollipop. I'm not exaggerating. Like, licking in this really lascivious way. The people there are just, like, quite trashy, quite tacky, like, babies crawling around. Like, it's just, like, something out of, like, a Trump information ad. It's, like, it's so bonkers. And she goes, "Oh, my God, I can't do this." And so she leaves, and she calls her best friend and goes, "I couldn't do it. My baby has fingernails." And her friend goes, "Your baby has fingernails? Well, you can't possibly have an abortion." And she goes, "Damn, my baby has fingernails." And this is an independent movie made by liberal people, written by a woman, written by Diablo Cody, like, aimed at liberal audiences. And this, and everyone was just like, "Yeah, fine, that's cool." And Knocked Up came out, which I'm sure also a lot of you have seen, the Judd Apatow comedy in which Katherine Hagel gets unexpectedly pregnant on a one-night stand the night before she's starting her dream job. And it's like, she doesn't even consider having an abortion, which I suspect most 22-year-olds in Los Angeles probably would. And the only person who suggests it is her mother, who goes, "Just get it sorted, and then you can have a real baby." And Katherine Hagel reels back, going, "Oh, that's a terrible thing to say." Which is supposed to be what the audience is going, "Oh, what a terrible thing to say, a real baby." And she's like, "No, of course I'm having this baby with someone who I slept with once, whose name I can't remember, who I hate, and who physically repulses me, and I'm about to start a job TV presenting. Of course I'm having this baby." And it's like, I'm not saying everyone should have abortions. I have two children myself. Like, I am pro-children. But, like, if you're going to not have an abortion in a movie, if a woman's going to decide not to have an abortion, it should be for realistic reasons. It should not be because, like, "Oh, abortions are evil." And it should not be like, "Oh, my baby has fingernails." Like, you shouldn't be swayed by a 14-year-old protester in front of a clinic. Like, that's insane, and that's an insane message to send to teenage girls. But there are no movies today that show positive depictions of abortion. Like, there was one that came out a year and a half ago called Obvious Child, which was an independent movie with Jenny Slate, which I really, really liked, and I highly recommend to all of you, where a girl gets pregnant after a one-night stand, and she decides to have an abortion. But the whole movie is about this decision. Like, this, it's like this, you know, very torturous decision, and of course it is a big decision to make, and it's hard. And one of the last scenes is sort of like lying on the gurney with a tear going down her face, but she has it done. But it's like the whole movie. And the fact is, one in three women will know somebody who's got an abortion, and probably or had an abortion themselves. And it doesn't have to be the whole story. Like, it's not the whole story of a woman's life. And when you look at other movies in the 80s that show abortions, it's not just Dirty Dancing. It's like things like Fame and Fast Times at Ridgemont High. It's really just a moment in the film, and the woman goes on and has a perfectly happy life. She's not traumatized forever. It doesn't affect her for the rest of her life. Like, just, you know, has to have it done. It's not something you particularly choose to do on a sunny day, but, like, you know, if you have to have it done, you get it done, and then she goes on. Like, it's not the whole plot of the film. Whereas now, it's, like, so conservative the way they treat abortion. It just makes me furious. And you look at Dirty Dancing, and you think, this could never happen now. And, in fact, it definitely couldn't happen now, because Hollywood studios inevitably came to Eleanor Bergstein recently saying, you'll never guess, they want to do a remake of Dirty Dancing, like they do of every single 80s movie now. But they said, we're going to take out the abortion. And she said no. And she refused it. And they said, well, it's non-negotiable. And she went, well, too bad. So she took the money, walked away, and instead put it on as the West End musical, which I'm sure all of you have seen in Leicester Square, and has made literally $500 million out of that by amping, and she amped up the abortion plot. If you go see it, like, it's way more.
Does it have a song?
It's like a whole thing. It's got a little dance. It's a huge thing in it. And they really amp up the risks that everyone was taking helping this woman, how, you know, Patrick Swayze's character, Johnny Castle, could have gone to prison, the father could have gone to prison, baby could have gone to prison. And it's made $500 million. But still, like, movies today are just like, no, illegal, scary stuff. It's crazy. It's crazy how conservative it's gotten.
Well, before we move on from Dirty Dancing, I just want to take an aside and talk about, so the guy, the actor who gets the woman pregnant,
oh, yeah,
and sort of dumps her.
Amazing.
Again, something that people wouldn't be giving credit for nowadays in the film, his whole character is basically described when he says something like, you know, oh, I'm reading this book, it's great, and it's the Fountainhead, yeah, and they don't have to explain that. But he's Max Cantor, the actor that played him. He has an incredible off-screen story.
So sad. I mean, he's this guy who grew up very near where I grew up in New York, son of a musical conductor. And he decided he was sick of movies after making this film. And, you know, really, I mean, once you've peaked with Dirty Dancing, the only way is down. So I don't really blame him for quitting at that point. And he became an investigative reporter. And he got very involved in the story down the Lower East Side of Manhattan then, which was then very kind of dangerous, about this kind of creepy, like, possible cannibal cult. And he died while investigating it. He, like, started taking drugs with them to get involved, and he died. But nobody's sure, and he said at the time, they're going to kill me, because he was close to exposing them. And it's still a story that actually this cannibal cult, it killed him with heroin. But it's this sort of crazy story about what happened to this character, because it's so strange from what, you know, what his character is in the movie. And at the same time, he is quite evil in the movie. So, but it's such a horrible, sad story. That's like a fascinating backstory to what happened. Like, I don't know. It was one of the many fascinating backstories of that film.
So you mentioned the John Hughes movies.
Yes.
And the next one I want to talk about is Pretty in Pink, which again is one of those films that I'd never managed to see at the time.
Never wanted to see
Watched in... Although, no, that's not fair because I'd seen most of the other... I've seen The Breakfast Club.
But there's
at the time,
a reason you didn't see that one. I mean, because it is the girls' one.
Maybe the title. But... Pretty in Pink, again, watching that in preparation for this, hated it.
Yeah. You hated it, really?
But I hated it not because of the film, not because Molly Ringwald's great, Harry Dean Stanton's great. The film is brilliant. There's this awful friend zone guy who's her best friend.
Ducky.
Who is just unbearable.
Yeah,
Every time he's on screen, it's awful.
I know, it's so weird. So again, okay, let's do this. How many of you have seen Pretty in Pink before I get talked too much into this? Fewer. So how many of you haven't? All the men. and a few women. So I'll try to explain this really quickly. So it's Molly Ringwald plays Andy, who's like a working class girl, and her best friend is Ducky, played by John Cryer, who is desperately in love with her, but she does not feel that way about him. And she falls for the rich boy called Blaine. I know, Ducky goes, Blaine? Is that a kitchen of clients? Blaine? Played by Andrew McCarthy. And it's their love triangle, and also their class triangle, because all of John Hughes' films are always about... all of his teen films are about social class. I'm not going to say National Lampoon's Vacation is about class, but all of his teen films are definitely about social class. And... It's a problem in the film, because originally it was supposed to be that Andy ends up with Ducky, and that's how the film was originally made, and they showed this to teen audiences at screenings, and they were all just like, this sucks, she has to end up with Blaine. And the problem is they just cast it in this way that made it impossible, because originally it was going to be Molly Ringwald, and then Robert Downey Jr. as Ducky, and Charlie Sheen as Blaine, which then makes you, of course, want her to end up with Ducky. I mean, you know, Robert Downey Jr., you know, for whatever anybody thinks of it, no one does appealing nerds like Robert Downey Jr. He was so good at that in the 80s. He was very handsome. And Charlie Sheen, you know, always just looked like a douche. Like, let's be honest about it. Like, nobody wants their friend to end up with Charlie Sheen. So, of course, you want Molly Ringwald to go off with Robert Downey Jr. in the end. But they cast John Cryer, and there are many good things to say about John Cryer. For example, he managed to work with Charlie Sheen for many years and come out alive. But, like, you don't, like, he's not the romantic hero at the end of the film. He's just not. So they have to have it end with Blaine. And the other problem is that he's much... John Cryer, his need for Andy comes across as much whinier than you can imagine Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah. Sort of.
Robert Downey Jr. would have been like self-deprecating and funny and charming, and John Cryer just comes across as a bit whiny and verging on men's rights activist, if we're going to go there.
Well, I wonder if in the 1980s that would have been as apparent as it is now, because he absolutely comes across as a whining men's rights activist.
Yeah, and like the kind of guy who'd be like, I put in all those hours with her, why won't she kiss me? Like those kind of crazy men who write things like that. I don't think it would have, but I think just girls did not fancy him is the problem for poor old John Cryer. I'm sorry to say that to him. Molly Ringwald gave an interview a few years ago when she tried to excuse the end of the film, which doesn't really make sense because they just refilmed the end of the film many months later and have her end up, sorry, spoiler alert for a movie made 30 years earlier, end up with Blaine. And
Ducky inexplicably scores with some hot chick
with the amazing blonde girl who ended up being the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Anyway, long story. So Bonnie Ringwald tried to explain this nonsensical ending, going, "I always thought Ducky was gay." Which seems kind of bogus. And John Cryer took this so badly and, like, reacted exactly the way you think Ducky would. Just like, just because I was shy doesn't make me gay. Just like, All right, people, tone down the weird 80s homophobia. Take it back a few decades. So I think it ended how it had to end. Also, like, I think she should end with Blaine, because I speak as a girl who never got the guy she wanted in high school. I was the one with the unrequited crushes all the time. And you think, good, Andy should get the hot guy. Why shouldn't the funny, weird girl who dresses strangely get the hot guy in a movie for once? Fine, and that's what I like about that movie. But I totally agree. It doesn't really make sense. And Ducky is not terrific in that film.
The other key aspect of that film is that it's, you know, it's highlighted all the way through. She's obviously from a working class background with a single dad, Hodie and Stanton. And she makes her own clothes. And
yes.
She's going to make her own dress for the prom.
The worst dress.
Yeah, there's no way. There's no way of getting away from, even on a perspective of looking back at the 80s and 80s fashion, that Andy is a terrible designer.
Oh, totally. But that's also kind of the point, I think. Like, when you look at who she's talking to at school, like, when people go on about 80s fashion, like, you don't see that actually in John Hughes films. It's the girls who are mean to her who are wearing like the rah-rah skirts and the crop tops and like the, you know, the ponytails on the side and all that crazy 80s stuff. Andy just dresses like a crazy person. But that's kind of the point. It's supposed to be she does her own thing. She's not following the crowd. And, if the price of looking like a mental person is what you have to pay for being original, then that's price worth paying, basically. If the price of being original means you dress like a crazy person, then great. So that's kind of John Hughes' point. Is she's supposed to look bonkers. And what's so funny about it is the whole way through she's going up how she wants to be a fashion designer. And you're all just like, really? I mean, she takes her best friend's prom dress, Iona's prom dress, and like cuts the shoulders out and like makes a polo neck. Now, try to imagine this. So it's like pink dress with like shoulders cut out here, sleeves, polo neck, like a white skirt coming out here. Like, it's the most crazy thing you've ever seen. But I think that is sort of the point. Like, there's no other way to explain. And when I interviewed Molly Ringwald for the book, even she said when she opened that dress, she was just like, that is the most, that's the pig ugliest thing I've ever seen in my life. I can't believe I've got to wear this on screen. So they all knew this when they were making it. So it's not about 80s fashion. I think people look at John Hughes movies and go, well, that's crazy 80s fashion. No, it's like, no, that's just crazy. Like,
Molly Ringwald herself is interesting as an actress because she was sort of Hughes' muse for all of those films, and then they basically fall out.
Well, they fell out because she refused to be in Some Kind of Wonderful, which was the last teen film he made, because she wanted to grow up. And he took this rejection so badly that he never spoke to her again. And in fact, he stopped speaking to her during the making of Pretty in Pink. They had been like best friends in a way that sounds a bit dodgy when I try to describe it, but I genuinely believe it wasn't dodgy. Like, she was a teenager, he was about 33, married with kids, and he used to take her and Anthony Michael Hall, who's in Weird Science, which I'm sure the boys here have seen, and Breakfast Club. And he would take them out to movies, he'd take them to gigs, he introduced them to music, like all the music in John Hughes' films, like that's all from John Hughes. He loved those kind of 80s indie bands. And they both pulled away. So Anthony Michael Hall refused to be in Ferris Bueller, and Molly Ringwald turned down Some Kind of Wonderful because they both wanted to grow up. And he never spoke to them again, and he stopped making 80s teen films entirely. Now, he actually did pretty well out of that because he then made Home Alone. So, you know, he was crying into his bank account. But he never really made movies as heartfelt as those teen films. He never really got over that heartbreak. And Matthew Broderick said this too when I interviewed him for the book as well. Like, once you pulled away from John Hughes, he never really forgave you. And they all sort of had tiny reconciliations with him towards the end. Like, Molly Ringwald told me he sent her a bunch of flowers towards the end of her life and just congratulating her on a play or something that she'd done. And it was his little reconciliation, but he was basically Peter Pan in that he created this Neverland around him and he had these kids in, but once you left Neverland, that was it. You're never going back and you can never speak to Peter Pan again. And it kind of broke his heart. All of his friends say that it really broke his heart. And when she left him, his new muse was John Candy. And he, who he had an incredibly close relationship with. And they made one of my favorite 80s movies, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which I don't talk so much about in the book, actually. But, and then when John Candy died, that was it for him. His heart really broke. He never made any more movies. And he died just a couple of years later. So it's a very sad story. I mean, those movies feel so heartfelt because for John Hughes, those feelings were right under the skin. Like, he really felt them. And when those kids left him, it was like his world ended in a funny sort of way.
Sort of explains Ducky a bit.
I mean, I think he is a lot of those characters. I mean, he definitely is the Ducky character, and he definitely is Anthony Michael Hall's character in Breakfast Club. Mm-hmm. And Ferris Bueller is his fantasy of what his childhood could have been like, because he grew up lower working class in a middle class area, and which is why he's so obsessed with class in his movies. And Ferris Bueller is the only hero he ever made who is clearly like upper middle class and is popular, has the hot girl, you know, has the friends, you know. And all the message of all John Hughes's films is that you have to be rich to be popular in American high school. And speaking as someone who went to American school, I can say, sadly, that is weirdly true in a lot of them. It is very weirdly classist and money obsessed. And Ferris is kind of like his fantasy. Ferris Bueller is clearly Ducky. Like, they were written at the same time and played by actors who are basically identical. But Ferris is rich, his parents love him, and he has a happier life.
Well, yeah, let's move on to that. Anthony Michael Hall's agent presumably sacked at that point, because that's the worst career decision ever, I think. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which I think probably of all of these films, personally, is, you know, the sort of standalone, absolute
perfection,
classic, yeah. And will remain so. But before we talk about it, I mean, I want to just rant about high school movies briefly for a moment.
Sure.
Because I've never really, I mean, they're probably not as popular in the UK as they are in America, but they're very popular over here as well, American high school films. I've never really understood it. It seems a bit weird and a bit creepy. First of all the actors are in their 30s,
sure,
playing high school children.
Definitely.
Which is odd.
Yes.
The obsession with school as the best years of your life, when clearly it isn't, is, yeah, also, like, weirdly odd.
Yeah.
And this is a classic example of that, because Ferris Bueller is, like, the coolest kid in the world.
Yeah.
But he's not as cool as anybody that can smoke and vote and have sex, as far as I'm concerned. Anybody in the world.
Well,
however,
yes,
it's, yeah, this film is it's superb. And as you just mentioned, that it was made at the same time. John Hughes made it,
yeah,
wrote it. It's written, it's, the two productions were pretty much overlapping,
yeah,
the same year. And they look so different. The look, yeah, of both films.
They're directed by different people, is the first, mm-hmm, thing. Pretty in Pink was directed by Howard Deutsch, who then went on to marry Leah Thompson, who is the mother in Back to the Future. Fascinating fact for you. And they met while making Some Kind of Wonderful together, which is a very sweet story. And John Hughes directed Ferris. John Hughes didn't direct very often. He directed Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Well, one of the things I was going to say, I think, is it sort of stands out as a classic, is it doesn't have that look of an 80s film.
Yes, that's right. It's much brighter. Mm. It's got a sheet. It's glossier. Because it's a fantasy. I mean, it's the craziest movie. There are so many incredibly enjoyable theories on the internet about what is Ferris Bueller actually about. And there is a very popular theory that Ferris is actually a figment of Cameron's imagination. And he's just like Cameron's kind of secret alter ego. Or I can't even think, what is that J.K. Rowling thing? Your Patronus. It's like, he's basically Cameron's Patronus. And that's not how I read it at all. But I do think Ferris Bueller, it is Cameron's story. Cameron's the one who goes through the emotional trajectory. Cameron's the one who changes at the end. Cameron's the one who's got stuff at risk, namely the car. Whereas Ferris has nothing at risk. And Ferris is the same at the end as he is at the beginning. He learns nothing throughout the film, except that he's awesome. And I think, so to me, I've always thought this movie is just seen through Cameron's eyes. So as much as, and this, and like everybody had this friend at school and after school for whom everything seemed to come easy. Like everyone has this friend who you idealize, you know, who you think is the one who always gets the girl, who like, you know, can, you know, study for a test an hour before and get an A or whatever. And that is Ferris to Cameron. So I don't think we're seeing Ferris the truth. We're seeing him through Cameron's eyes.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the class aspect of this film then, because you said it's these are rich kids,
yeah,
in this film.
Yeah.
It's not, so Pretty in Pink is very much explicitly saying there's a class struggle here in the whole high school system.
I mean, they live literally on the wrong side of the,
yeah,
tracks. She literally has to cross the train tracks to get home. I mean, you know, John Hughes is not a subtle man.
But Ferris is still, it's still about the class system,
yes,
in perhaps, yeah, a more subtle way. So what's going on there?
So, well, it's Cameron who's the rich one, and Ferris who's upper middle class. I mean, Ferris lives in the kind of house that basically Macaulay Culkin then lives in Home Alone. This kind of big suburban American houses that look insane from here. They look enormous with like the two cars. But actually in America, it's kind of just middle class, because America, there's so much land. You can have these big houses in the middle of Chicago. And so it's still saying, he's still saying that Cameron, because he's richer, is unhappier. I mean, John Hughes always has this point that the richer you are, the unhappier you are. So Cameron's parents are horrible. He's, you know, he lives in a museum, all that kind of stuff. So the whole point is that Cameron is miserable because his parents have so much money, and therefore they love money more than him. And he has to destroy that in order to get his parents to love him. But I just want to say about the high school thing. I do think the thing with American high school movies is, Like, Americans know that these movies are ridiculous. And they're only showing a certain type of high school. They're showing suburban public schools, which is, you know, where a lot of kids go in America. It's actually not where I went. I went to school in Manhattan, and I also went to a private school. So my school experience looked nothing like that. And to be honest, for most kids, their schools look nothing like that. Anybody who goes to school, for example, in Los Angeles, you go to a big public school in Los Angeles, it's different from going to school out in the suburbs. But what America loves to do is mythologize itself through the movies. So, you know, I would say that what Westerns are pre-1960s to American cinema is what high school is post-1960s. You have these real genres, this idea that this means something, this period of time, being in high school. You have the, you know, the different cliques or whatever. In the same way, in the Western movies, it's like, this means something. We're defining America through the Western. Yeah. And here you have the saloon, and here you have the gun-toting bad guy, and here you have the good guy. This is exactly the same. They're just using different tropes, and they've just moved the Western to the high school, and they're just telling people, this is, you know, this says something about America, these high schools. This says something about the American experience. When for most people, I mean, I'm speaking as someone who hasn't been in high school for 20 years, you forget school as soon as you go. Like, don't you? You go to college or you go to work. So they know that it's ridiculous, and it's definitely not supposed to be representative of any reality, as Heathers then completely satirized just 2 years after John Hughes stopped doing this.
Let's move on to... Let's have a look. What should we talk about next? When Harry Met Sally and the rom-com, which, again, they're still around.
But
rom-coms are something that, you know, we just think nowadays that they're just always terrible.
Terrible.
And the 80s is a sort of classic era of the rom-com. So, well, tell us why you like When Harry Met Sally so much, first of all, and then we'll talk about what went wrong with the...
I mean, I feel almost like I'm just stating the obvious with this. I mean, obviously everyone loves When Harry Met Sally. It's got to be in everybody's top 10 movies, surely. The thing that's so brilliant about it is that it cares as much about the men as the women. And it's as sympathetic to both sides. And it shows the flaws on both sides. And that is so rare with a rom-com when they're either aimed at men, in which case they're like things like Something About Mary or Ben Stiller, or women, in which case they're now, I mean, they became, you know, Kate Hudson or Drew Barrymore. But When Harry Met Sally, it doesn't underestimate its audience, which almost all rom-coms started to do post the mid-1990s. And it's not simplistic, and it feels so real, and every line is so true. And there's no kind of awkward machination of the plot. Nobody's behaving like a crazy person. And what normally rom-coms do is they make men behave like dicks, and women behave like crazy people. And it doesn't matter who they're aimed at, but that's how they are. Men are horrible, and women are insane. And When Harry Met Sally doesn't do that. It's just like, here are two people. And sometimes it takes people 13 years to get together. And that's not because they actually secretly hate each other. It's because they're humans, and that's how life goes. And it's so funny along the way, and it's also so clever how it parallels that love story with the story of Bruno Kirby and Carrie Fisher as their friends, which is unbelievably hilarious. It's a movie for grown-ups, which you don't get a lot of these days, but you got loads of in the 80s, actually. And the 70s, of course, too. But in the 80s, you definitely got movies for grown-ups, and now we just don't see those.
I think it even goes further than that with rom-coms, in that not only is it just like the men are assholes and the women are crazy, but the situations in them are basically like... Well, you mentioned Something About Mary, which is like a classic example of that. There's this woman who... Is it three men are chasing? And they're all basically stalkers.
They're all horrible, I know.
They're all, like, literally stalking
her. Yeah, I know. And this is often the way, weirdly, with rom-coms. When you actually take a step back and look, you think, this is illegal, actually. I mean, even movies I love, like Say Anything, which we may or may not have time to speak about, which I love so much, and I hope all of you will see or have seen, Cameron Crowe, John Cusack, Ione Skye. I mean, even that, when Ione Skye dumps John Cusack, and he keeps coming back and, like, holding a radio, a boombox, outside the window, he's like... a little bit stalkery. That's a tiny bit creepy. You're playing the song you had sex to underneath her window after she's dumped you. It's a bit icky. Let's put it in the icky category, maybe. But definitely, like, there's something about Mary is so horrible. And so many of these movies are like that. I mean, I was like, you look at movies, okay, so rom-coms, I would say, this is what happened to the rom-com, basically. So rom-coms started really coming up in the 80s again with things like When Harry Met Sally. Then the 90s, they exploded with Pretty Woman. So Pretty Woman, the blockbuster that killed everything. Then you had this whole slew of mighty rom-coms starring Drew Barrymore, things like The Wedding Singer and Never Been Kissed. And then studios were like, huh, we've been giving all these movies to the women. What about the guys? And it turned around and it became these unbelievably appalling, creepy Ben Stiller films like Along Came Polly and obviously There's Something About Mary. And they became more and more insulting to the audiences, and more insulting to both sexes, and sort of culminated with the worst movie ever made, called The Unbelievable Truth, starring Gerard Butler and Catherine Hagel. Hold yourselves back.
That's really all you need to say there. But.
Which is like the worst thing you'll ever see in your life. Like, it's literally like my eyes were bleeding when I came out of the cinema. And at that point, everyone's like, oh, they're crap. Like, nobody wants to see this. It's like, nobody wants to see them because you're making them badly. Like, if When Harry Met Sally came out today, which it wouldn't, but if it did, it'd be a huge hit. Everybody would be like, oh, this is like Woody Allen, but better. And they'd be right. But nobody makes that movie. They'd be like, this isn't sexy. You know, they're old. It's boring. 13 years? It takes 13 years? What the hell? There's one sex scene? What are you talking about? So it just wouldn't get made today.
You mentioned that When Harry Met Sally should be definitely in everybody's top 10, but your favourite film is Ghostbusters.
Yes.
Tell us why.
I love Ghostbusters. I mean, there's a lot of nostalgia, obviously, there, in that Ghostbusters to me is really a love story to New York in the 80s, and obviously I grew up in New York in the 80s, and so what I see on screen is basically my childhood, with, like, you know, the garbage on the streets, and, like, the cars kind of whizzing around the corners, and everyone being really rude, and no one batting an eye at these four guys jogging along with nuclear reactors on their backs while smoking cigarettes. Like, everything about it is, like, so adorable. But I really love it because it's a movie that manages to be about male friendship without either demonizing women or insulting the men. And when the men do behave badly, as Bill Murray does a lot in that movie, he is called up on it by often Sigourney Weaver, to be honest, which I really like. What the male friendship story in it comes from, the fact that it was written by Dan Aykroyd for his best friend, John Belushi, who was this big comedic actor, I'm sure. You know, you've all known as Bluto and stuff like that in the 70s comedies. And as he was writing in his apartment in New York, and as he was writing a line for Venkman, who was going to be played by Belushi, he got a call from L.A. saying that Belushi had been found dead in, I think it was Chateau Marmont, or Beverly Hills Hotel, one of the two, of a drugs overdose. And the whole movie is a really, I mean, obviously he was devastated, and he still got Belushi into the film through the character of Slimer, because Belushi used to go through hotel lobbies and eat food off room service trays, and so that's what Slimer is. And you feel this real sense of fondness between particularly the three original Ghostbusters, so Aykroyd, Ramis, and Belushi. Aykroyd, Ramis, and Murray, who were all friends and knew each other from Saturday Night Live days. And you really get that sense of camaraderie, and also that sense of, I mean, when you know that the whole thing's about Belushi, really, which the movie is kind of a lot about Belushi, there's a real kind of sense of the importance of them being friends. Like, they have a real friendship between them, which I find quite moving, and they're really fond of each other, and they're funny with each other, but it's not that kind of Apatow bromance thing. It's done in almost a kind of grown-up way. And when you have to say the Ghostbusters look more grown-up than many movies today, I mean, that seems like a real sad state of affairs. come on, it's just so funny, that movie. It's so funny there's not a line in that movie that isn't funny. Every line is hilarious. You just want to quote every single line in that all the day long. That might just be me.
The last time we spoke, the new Ghostbusters film hadn't been released yet, so you haven't seen it. And when it came out, you wrote a pretty positive review of it. Now the dust settled a bit. Before we talk about the film, let's ask that, you know, what's now becoming a sort of eternal question. What is wrong with people on the internet?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Like, I mean, honestly, like, you know, like I said, I love Ghostbusters. I wasn't so thrilled when I heard they were remaking all my favorite 80s movies. But, you know, they're not destroying my childhood. If your childhood is destroyed by someone with a vagina getting into a Ghostbusters uniform, your childhood has so many problems with it. I mean, I would like to help your childhood. But I don't think shouting at Melissa McCarthy on the internet is going to help your childhood. Like, you don't want to make generalizations about, men are idiots or whatever. But, God, some of you men on the internet, don't make it easy for us. People, they're crazy. There's no other way to say it. Some people have so little in their lives, and I'm saying this as someone who's written a whole damn book about 80s movies. Some people have so little in their lives that they define their whole lives by 80s pop culture. And, like, you know, I feel sympathy with these people, but these people are insane. They are insane. And, you know, and I went to this movie, I went to review it for The Guardian, and I'm going to be honest, I didn't love it. I liked it. I didn't love it. I mean, I came out thinking that felt a bit pointless. Like, why would you do that? But I'm glad they did it, because I know why they did it. Paul Feig, who directed it, who also made Bridesmaids and The Heat, wants to prove to Hollywood that women can carry big films. And he has done that. This movie hasn't done as well as his other films. But it's a good point to make. I mean, rather than just randomly remaking or rebooting, you know, Jurassic Park or whatever, whatever the crap they turn out now. Like, fine, they're making a point that women can carry action comedies. Great. It's not going to be a classic in the way the first one is. And I'm not just saying that through nostalgia bias. Like, it's just not as funny. It's not as original. Nice try. Don't really see the point.
The other thing, you know, that obviously comes into your mind when you think about these people making a fuss about their childhoods being ruined by Ghostbusters being remade.
Christ.
Have none of these people seen Ghostbusters 2?
I know, but that's... I mean, like, that's the thing. Nobody seems bothered about that. That's what's so weird. And I'm telling you this for free. Like, the Paul Feig Ghostbusters is better than Ghostbusters 2. Like... Oh, is that my cue to stop talking?
No, we're a long way off.
Ghostbusters 2, I don't know how many of you have seen it. It's ridiculous. It involves a talking painting. And that's kind of all you need to know about Ghostbusters 2. The oversensitivity is... I mean, let's be honest, they're just using it as an excuse for misogyny. And then it became an excuse for racism against Leslie Jones. But all in the name of defending Ghostbusters. And what became so hilarious is when then poor Dan Aykroyd, he's probably like 65, 68 at this point, like tweeted like a little gentle grandfatherly support going, really excited about the new Ghostbusters. And these people were screaming out, who the fuck are you? You ruined my... I was like, he wrote the movie. Total moron. It's like, these people are like, it's a new world where fans feel they have proprietorship over movies, and it's the whole thing with like Comic-Con and all that, where fans can tell J.J. Abrams how he should do Star Wars, and in some cases that's great kind of interaction, but when it tips over into fans feeling like they own the product and no one else can touch it and only they understand it, only they're pure enough to really understand the true meaning of this original movie, then you think, sir, you need to go outside and have a walk in the sunshine and maybe get away from the computer.
Another genre of films, which I think is pretty much over, although we could probably think of some examples that have been made since the 80s and 90s. And again, one film that I still, unfortunately, haven't managed to bring myself to watch. Which one do you think it is?
I'm going to guess Steel Magnolias.
You're right, it is Steel Magnolias. However, I have nothing against the genre of what used to be called women's films per se. Lots
women.
Of those other films.
I just don't want to watch them.
Lots of those other films I have seen. Fried Green Tomatoes is a film that I enjoy very much.
You would like Steel Magnolias.
I probably
then.
Would, yeah. But just haven't got around to it. However, that film, and the women's film is something that has existed, you know, forever in the 50s.
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely made. But, the, you know, there's ones we can all think of from the 80s, which were very definite. You know, a cast of 10 big name women in there.
Yeah.
And all of your mum and your sisters and your aunts would all go together to see these films.
Good night out.
And again, these things just don't seem to,
don't
seem to happen anymore. I was trying to think of the last one. And the last one I could probably think of is something like Mamma Mia or something.
The Help would be a very good one. But The Help, first of all, The Help is about Hollywood's favourite storyline, which is white people solve racism, which is always a winner. And the average age in that movie, I think, is 32, whereas the average age in Steel Magnolias is about 57, which is amazing and brilliant. And also, I'm going to assume that not many people here have seen Steel Magnolias, but take it from me. You would rather watch Steel Magnolias 1,000 times than The Help twice. Like, I just promise you, Steel Magnolias is so funny. It's like so, so funny. Like, you're looking at me like you don't believe me.
I will make a point of watching it.
Who doesn't want to watch Dolly Parton and Shirley MacLaine and Olympia Dukakis and Sally Field, like Daryl Hannah? Like, they're so funny in this movie. And the other great 80s, you know, women's movies, obviously, Beaches, which I'm going to assume a lot of people here have seen, and fewer people, Terms of Endearment, which is also hilarious and all of you should see. And they absolutely do not make movies like that anymore.
So why? I mean, this is still half the population. Why do they assume there's not an audience?
And the majority of cinema goers, in fact, with 60% women is women. But it's because, so the reason all of this has changed is that by the end of the 80s, the big Hollywood studios were all bought up by conglomerates. So things like Viacom and, you know, water companies and stuff. So rather than being run by people who love movies, they're being run by companies to make money. And I'm not saying that 80s Hollywood was all about, like, the benevolent giving art to the people. Obviously, 80s Hollywood wanted to make money. But now these studios are being run by people who don't have very much interest in movies themselves. And they started doing these things where they divide audiences up into quadrants. So it's like men, women, teenage boys, teenage girls. And they want to make movies that hits as many quadrants as possible. And the theory is still, and it has been for the past 20 years, that men will go to movie, that women will go to movies starring men, but men won't go to movies starring women. So therefore, movies starring men will get both men and women. But movies starring women will just get women. So that's not much. And teenage girls will go see movies about teenage boys, but teenage boys won't go see movies about teenage girls. So that's why you have loads of superhero movies and stuff. And when you do have girls in movies, they're action and there are other boys in there. So Hunger Games was the outlier. But that was considered, that had enough violence in order to bring in teenagers. It's got killing. So therefore that could bring in the teenage boys. And the other big change that happened is in the 80s, 80% of an audience, when a movie would be made by Hollywood, and 80% of its takings would come from America, 20% would come from overseas, quite a bit, really, from England and France. Now, when a movie is made, 80% of its takings come from overseas, so it's entirely flipped. And a lot of that is mainly from China, a bit from Russia, some from India. And the theory is that audiences there don't want to see women, they don't want to see teenage girls, they don't want to see sex, and they don't want complicated dialogue that's too hard to translate. Because, you know, it's very hard to translate When Harry Met Sally for, you know, a Chinese rural audience. But it's not hard to translate loads of special effects and shooting, which is why there's so many superhero movies now, because they're all literally made for China. And it's also why you don't get positive depictions of abortion anymore. And it's why you don't get discussions about American class system anymore, because they're like, nobody gives a damn about that in Russia. So you've lost the specificity of these movies when they would really be about Chicago. All of John Hughes' films are about Chicago. When people think of Chicago, they think of Ferris Bueller running through the, you know, museum and stuff. And now all movies are kind of in some sort of bland, unspecified Los Angeles, bland, unspecified New York. And they're all just about explosions and violence. Sex is the other thing that went. No more romantic, loving depictions of sex like you get in Say Anything. What you get instead is lots of violence. So you think of the big teen franchises now, in the past 15 years, that would be Twilight, Hunger Games, and to a certain extent, Harry Potter. And those movies are not about sex. They do not have sex. Any positive depictions of eroticism, no. I mean, in fact, in Twilight, the girl is at risk of dying from having sex. And in fact, starts being eaten from within by her vampire baby. I mean, that's how bad sex is now. But there is loads and loads of violence and special effects in those movies, because that's seen as fine to celibacy. So that's why, if you're wondering, why don't they make movies like they did before? But I don't want to sound like an old codger sitting on the porch when I ask that. There is actually a reason. You're not an old codger sitting on the porch. The reason is the entire movie-making industry has changed in the past 30 years.
Right, one last thing from me before we move on to ask some questions from the audience. Not a specific film this time, but a career. Mm. Again, it seems quite odd looking back from this point, thinking of his latter work, but by far the biggest star of the 1980s was Eddie Murphy.
My hero, yes.
What happened?
I love Eddie Murphy so much. I know some people are trying not to laugh. Like, I really love Eddie Murphy. It's so sad. Like, I'm upset.
I was absolutely obsessed with Eddie Murphy in the 1980s.
I still am obsessed with Eddie Murphy. He's so amazing. And when you watch his 80s movies again, you're just like, how were we lucky enough to live in this time? Like, he's so funny. He's so charismatic. He's just the best thing on screen you've ever seen. And what happened was, it's very sad. So I interviewed John Landis for the book. So I should say also, I've interviewed lots of 80s people in this book. Like, it's not just me yammering on like it has been right now. So it's all that people who made these movies are in the book. So I interviewed John Landis, who directed Eddie Murphy in Trading Places and Coming to America, two of the most incredible films that he made in the 80s. And he said when he made Trading Places, he was like this young 22-year-old kid. He'd only really made he'd made 48 Hours, and he'd been on Saturday Night Live. And he was so excited, and he was so positive. By the time he came to Coming to America, he was jaded, he was bored, he felt himself already becoming dated and already being kind of pushed aside. And Eddie Murphy, what you have to understand about Eddie Murphy in order to really appreciate him, is he was the biggest star of the 80s. But it's hard to remember how unbelievably racist 80s Hollywood was at that point. And the way to remember it is if you look at 48 Hours, in which he co-starred with Nick Nolte. And Eddie is very much the second tier. He's the criminal who joins up with Nick Nolte's gruff cop to help him crack a crime. And Nick Nolte's cop is supposed to be gruff. He's supposed to be rough around the edges, all that kind of stuff. And the way he shows this is by being unbelievably racist to Eddie Murphy throughout the whole film, calling him watermelon, spear chucker, other words I'm definitely not allowed to say as a Guardian writer. Like so unbelievable. And you're kind of watching this like... And yes, He's supposed to be rough around the edges, but charming. Like, he's not a bad guy for saying it. You're not supposed to hate him for saying that. And by the end of the movie, when Eddie has proved he's not just another black guy, or whatever the hell he's supposed to be proving, he's actually a guy who can help solve crimes, Nick Nolte's like, yeah, I shouldn't have called you a spear chucker. And everyone's like, oh, that old twinkly-eyed codger. Like, it's so, like, that scene is like a charming character element that he kind of comes through. It's like, whoa, Nick Nolte took the real step there. That seems totally acceptable. And the only reason, like, Eddie Murphy said in an interview later, oh yeah, everyone was thought, like, he said a few years later after that, he said, everyone thought Nick Nolte was so racist. But, you know, the fact is, like, I'm seen on an equal level, so it's not like he's punching down. The truth is, Eddie Murphy's only on an equal level in that movie because he's Eddie Murphy. Like, he's so charismatic, he was able to lift that character up here to be on equal level with Nick Nolte. The fact is, that character is really written to be down here. He's like the sidekick. He's like that poor little Asian kid in Temple of Doom, really. Like, that is basically Eddie Murphy's character in 48 Hours. And also, let's think of Temple of Doom, if you really want to think of how racist 80s movies were. So the only reason it doesn't look like Nick Nolte's punching down is because Eddie Murphy was so charismatic in that character that he was able to bring himself up, so he looked on eye level. And that was it was amazing that he did that. And what he did then next is something that almost no African-American actor has been able to do since. He was then cast in a role that was specifically written for a white actor. So it was Beverly Hills Cop. And that was written, hold on to your seats, for Mickey Rourke. And when that fell through, they then cast, even better, Sylvester Stallone. Then he left, and then the producers were like, you know, like Don Simpson and...
Bruckheimer.
Thank you. Bruckheimer. God, you wouldn't think I'd written a book, would you? Don Simpson and Bruckheimer are like, you know what, let's actually cast Eddie Murphy. And so they bring in Eddie Murphy to carry this movie, and the only other time that's happened since is Morgan Freeman in Shawshank Redemption. Like, that character, when you read the original stories, is supposed to be a white Irish guy, which is why he's called Red. And then they cast Morgan Freeman. That's the only time that's happened since. And Eddie Murphy did that repeatedly over and over. He was cast in roles that were written for white actors because he was so undeniably, like, more talented than everybody else there. And that horrible cliche, that horrible truism, which is still true, which is, in order for an African-American person, particularly in America, to succeed, they have to be 1,000 times better than the white people around them. I mean, Eddie Murphy was 1,000,000 times better than everybody else. So in The Golden Child, that was written for Mel Gibson. And they cast Eddie Murphy. But the thing they changed with those roles is that they then took out any sex. So you never see Eddie Murphy having any kind of sexual effects. He's not seen sexually attractive in Beverly Hills Cop. He doesn't sleep with anybody. He doesn't have a girlfriend. There's nothing like Golden Child. He gets off with the woman, but you don't really see it. And it's, like, quickly covered up. It's, like, nothing. I mean, he has to in that movie. They can't get around that. And also, she's not white, which also makes it more acceptable in that film. You never see him with a white woman.
So Beverly Hills Cop, I mean, that's a great example there because, you know, he has a relationship with a woman who's an old friend from home.
And
she's not his sister or anything.
No. And who's following him around all the time at night.
And there's a scene where she's basically sprawling on
the bed.
Hotel
and she's, like, just kind of waiting, going, Axel, what are we doing tonight? And he's just kind of looking over the desk going, I think we've got to go to this, you know, warehouse and stuff. But he's supposed to be this cocky, hilarious, young, hip. I mean, like, his character should then be sleeping with her. But they couldn't do that. This was seen as too threatening to white audiences, particularly white male audiences, for a black man to have this kind of obviously sexual effect on white women, or really even any woman. So, like, even at the end of Trading Places, when they suddenly bust in a girlfriend for him, obviously they suddenly bust in this random black woman. Like, they can't ever have him having an interracial relationship. And I'm not saying I'm dying to see Eddie Murphy getting off with loads of white women in movies, but it's very, very obvious how nervous studio bosses were about this. They couldn't have him have sex on screen, and if he did get off with anybody in the very few movies they allowed this, she had to be black. Like, those were the rules.
Since we talked about this before, I've noticed it everywhere in films of that era. And just a couple of weeks ago, after Gene Wilder died,
yeah,
I was watching a few of his films.
Yeah.
Stir Crazy is a film that, when I was a kid, I absolutely adored. I mean, it hasn't aged well, but regardless of that.
Sadly, no Richard Pryor films have aged
but this
well.
It's really interesting to see that, in that there's Richard Pryor, there's Gene Wilder. Richard Pryor is obviously
less
cooler, you think less attractive. I was going to say more attractive, cooler, funnier in that film, in the role that he plays.
Yeah.
And yet, bizarrely, Gene Wilder is the romantic lead in that film.
I meant Richard Pryor's the more attractive. Sorry, that is what I meant.
So Gene Wilder is, he has the main relationship in the film. But also, whenever they go into a cafe, he's like looking at, you know, the waitress and stuff. And he's clearly the guy that is sexual.
Yeah.
And Richard Pryor is asexual.
Totally not.
And it's insane.
It's insane. And also totally illogical, really. Yes. I mean, when you know about their real personal lives, you're like, that really doesn't make any sense. But like the comparison with Richard Pryor is really interesting because Eddie kind of took Richard Pryor's place. He literally took his place in 48 hours. Richard Pryor had to back out. Eddie took his place and his career went like that. And he took over from Richard Pryor, as Eddie said at the time, as being like Hollywood's like the black guy. Like there was only allowed to be one at a time, apparently, at that point. And kind of, it's not much better now, let's be honest. But he was able to box out of the role of just being the black guy. Like, he then got to carry movies in a way that Richard Pryor never did, and he was cast in roles that were written for white actors. And Richard Pryor was never able to do that because Eddie Murphy just was so much more charismatic than anyone on screen, and really anyone since on screen. No one's ever been able to beat Eddie Murphy's 80s for me.
Well, I think on that point, let's hand it over to the audience for questions. Now, we've got some roving microphones because we are recording. So, has anybody got a question for Adley?
Thanks. Is big just wrong?
Oh, my God. Big is so wrong on so many levels. It's an amazing movie to watch now. I mean, it is about... He's supposed to be 13 in it, isn't he? 13-year-old boy who then, like, is living with this 32-year-old woman for 3 months and having sex. It's crazy. So I went off and interviewed Tom Hanks for the paper, but I was also writing the book at the same time. And it was for Captain Phillips or something. And then we were chatting, and at the end I had to say to him, I've got to ask you about Big, Tom, please. Like, it's a bit pedophile, isn't it? I mean, it's basically a movie about pedophilia, right? And he was like, oh, no. I was like, it's a bit weird. I mean, that boy is 13, and, like, he has sex with this woman for 3 months, and then she, like, watches him go back home at the end, turn into a 13-year-old boy, and it's like, oh. Isn't that lovely? Oh. And Tom Hanks, Mr. America, Mr., you know, James Stewart of our time, finally admitted, it's a bit weird. And I was like, it's totally weird. But what's really weird is you think, okay, what happened after, like, he went home? Like, how did that fall out? Because everyone knows Josh Baskin as this guy who was working in an office in New York. I mean, they would notice he hadn't turned up for work the next day. His apartment, what happened with that? I mean, people are somehow going to put together the fact that there's a kid, Josh Baskin, who was kidnapped in the suddenbs, and there's a grown-up Josh Baskin working in America, suddenly in New York, who suddenly disappeared. And when he disappeared, the kid turns back up. So this guy was probably the kidnapper. So what the hell was going on there? So, well, we need to find him. He must have had a social security number in order to get paid. I mean, the more you think about that movie, you think, Jesus, there was some scandal when that came through. Or did the girlfriend then get sent to prison for being a massive pedophile? Like, who knows? I mean, that movie, I love that movie, but you don't want to think too deeply about what happens after the closing credits.
Well, on that depressing point,
enjoy your Saturday.
I think in the little blurb I read out at the beginning, I completely forgot to include Hadley's book, Life Moves Pretty Fast, which you can't help but notice there was a big pile of on the way in. So if you buy one of those, no doubt Hadley will happily sign it for you. And you may also have noticed the massive pile of Little Atoms magazines, which if you don't already own, you should definitely get.
Definitely get.
So I've been Neil Denny, but if you would please put your hands together for Hadley Freeman.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.